Good afternoon. This is Richmond Independent Radio News for Friday, May 27th, 2005. I'm Lauren Ball. This week we take you inside the Performing Arts Center debate that has consumed City Hall and the Richmond community.
I don't think any of us had any idea how much money was being spent on what, or how much money had been raised.
We will also be speaking with Brett Bercy, who is currently appealing a conviction that has vital implications for civil liberties.
Yeah, I told him, I said, I'm in a free speech zone. It's called the United States of America.
And we will hear from our first WRIR News citizen commentator.
The NTSB has banned cigarette lighters on all planes. All this is done in what is purported to be the name of national security.
Those stories and more coming up after these headlines.
For WRIR News, I'm Matt Beckwith. This week has seen a host of new developments and changes in the city's budget. Last Friday, Mayor Wilder criticized City Council's proposition to cut $1.2 million from the city's police and social services departments. Council responded on Monday by preserving those funds and instead eliminating positions within Wilder's staff, including senior aide Paul Goldman, as well as his 9-person security team. The mayor's spokesman, Bill Farah, commented on Wilder's response to the cuts.
As far as the mayor's concerned, they did what he asked them to do, which was to make whatever adjustments they felt were appropriate to the budget. And that's what they did. And whatever, as I said, whatever happens with the budget from here on out will be theirs to approve or not approve.
Additionally, council dropped a $600,000 plan to renovate City Hall and move the mayor's office to a new location on the 17th floor, as well as a $25,000 pay raise it had proposed for Mayor Wilder. Over the weekend, Wilder stated that he would not accept a raise even if it were included in the budget. Controversy has recently plagued the Oregon Hill Home Improvement Council, known as OHIC. Members of the OHIC board intend to broaden the scope of the organization by becoming a community development corporation. The change would find OHIC branching out of Oregon Hill into areas as far away as Petersburg, and would also effectively deprive Oregon Hill residents from having a say in the decisions made by the OHIC board. Troubled by the possibility of having a limited role in the group, Oregon Hill residents gathered at St. Andrew's Church on Sunday night to voice their grievances. WRIR's Dustin Richardson reports.
Tensions were high under the Gothic spires of St. Andrew's Church as a polarized neighborhood came together, not to hear each other out as advertised, but to square off in one of the first official battles in what looks to be a long struggle for the future of Oregon Hill Home Improvement Council, and perhaps even the Hill itself. While the two sides agree that OHIC has had an overwhelmingly positive effect on the neighborhood that survived even riots during the Civil War, they are bitterly opposed on the future of the organization. The current board of directors started the meeting off with a presentation explaining why they think OHIC should be there for all Central Virginians.
What we've done, what we've passed on in this neighborhood, if we could pass that on to other people, other neighborhoods.
Active resident Charles Poole explained why he and others feel that this amendment to OHIC's bylaws is unfair.
What we see today is not getting their input, but saying, well, this is what we want to do. This is backwards.
While it is not expected that this debate will be over anytime soon, a vote on the issue is planned for June 12th. For WRIR, I'm Dustin Richardson in Oregon Hill.
As the state gears up for the Democratic primary elections on June 14th, the city of Richmond is updating its gear. The city has replaced all of the old lever-style voting booths with the new machines, which are about the size of a laptop computer and incorporate a touchscreen. City Registrar Kirk Showalter says she feels it's time for the city to step into the 21st century.
The Help America Vote Act of 2002 was enacted by Congress in reaction to the 2000 presidential election. And in that, they determined that the punch cards and lever machines should be replaced.
The next of several free tutorials on how to use the new machines will be given tonight at the Fridays at Sunset concert. This is WRIR News. The
This is your WRIR News weekend weather forecast. I'm Andrew Large. I don't really know that these climatic events will occur, but I suppose they might because they were borrowed verbatim from the National Weather Service, except where I paraphrased. Tonight, if there's any rain to clear up, that's what it will do. Clouds clearing with lows in the upper 50s. I promise you, tomorrow will be both partly sunny and partly cloudy. Perhaps it will get as high as 900, more likely around 80. For Sunday, guess. For WRIR News, I'm Andrew Large.
The Richmond SPCA is now offering free spaying and neutering to pets of qualified individuals living in Richmond, Henrico, Hanover, Chesterfield, and Goochland. They'll even pick up your pet if you'd like. A free rabies vaccination will be included. Having your pet spayed or neutered will improve their health and help save the lives of homeless animals in our community. More information and appointments are available by calling the Richmond SPCA Spay-Neuter Helpline at 521-1300.
For WRIR News, I'm Lauren Ball. Global warming is already destroying people's lives in Virginia, according to a video entitled We Are All Smith Islanders, produced by Chesapeake Climate Action Network, known as CCAN, and shown with a debate forum on May 24th at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Richmond. Christopher Maxwell reporting.
Film producer Mike Tidwell introduced the film and forum, noting that, quote, the key to this film is that it makes global warming comprehensible to people right where they live, end quote, here in Virginia and Maryland. Smith Island in the Chesapeake Bay, for example, is rapidly losing land, and farmers in rural Virginia are finding more erratic farming conditions that destroy crops. In another film example, in 1900, the geographic center of the United States maple industry was not New England, but Garrett County, Maryland. Wind power was proposed as a relatively benign solution to generating electrical power without creating greenhouse gases that accelerate global warming by trapping more of the sun's infrared heat energy than in previous years, such as a car windshield does. One of the forum participants, Alden M. Hathaway, director of Green Power Programs, noted that Virginia is all but primed for wind power.
Virginia is one of the top 20 states in total wind resources. And yet out of all 50 states, it ranks below 30 in terms of states that have actually developed wind.
Opponents of wind power have called windmills bird Cuisinarts, so film author Mike Tidwell explained that
there have been a lot of folks who say these wind farms are going to kill a lot of migratory birds. Thankfully, we've had 5 radar studies that show that the migratory birds do not collide with the proposed or existing wind farms. In fact, they fly well above the 400-foot height of most of these wind turbines, and the small percentage that fly below that 400-foot figure don't strike the turbines. And we know that because the bird fatalities are less than 4 per turbine per year. My cats kill more birds than that.
Alden is calling for a letter-writing campaign for citizens to ask Virginia state legislators to support plans in the upcoming Virginia state legislation session to allow counties to get credit for using wind power, as well as urging legislation supporting RPS, which is Renewable Portfolio Standards.
The state legislators need to pass the laws for a Renewable Portfolio Standard, also or either pass a law to give credit to counties that make the bold move of purchasing renewable energy on their own for air pollution credit.
You can hear the entire speeches of the forum participants at WRIR.org by clicking on the lower left side panel link labeled New Programs and looking for a homespun C-SPAN entry on this event. For WRIR, this is Christopher Maxwell reporting from Bird Park.
This morning, Brett Bercy appealed his 2003 conviction under Federal Law Statute 17, which regulates threats to the United States President, such as kidnappings and assassinations. Bercy is the president of the South Carolina Progressive Network, an activist group that promotes social and economic change in South Carolina. He was arrested during a 2003 appearance by President George W. Bush for refusing to go to a free speech zone, an area designated for protesters that, according to Bercy, are used to keep them out of sight of the media and general public. Though many people have been arrested by the Secret Service for not moving to a zone, Bercy is the first to be charged, and so his case will set a precedent for how these free speech zones will be enforced in the future. In his own words, Bercy is a good American who believes everything he learned in civics class about constitutional rights. He feels that these zones are unconstitutional and contends that all of America is a free speech zone. WRIR's Matt Beckwith met with him this morning just before his hearing at the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals.
The federal government is arguing that they arrested me because I knowingly and willfully entered into and refused to leave an area that was secured by the Secret Service for the physical safety of the president. Our argument is that I didn't have a clue that it was a nationally secured area. Nobody told me. I couldn't have willingly and knowingly violated it. The discussions the day I was arrested were all about me going to the free speech zone. It wasn't that they said, like, where I was standing was a federally restricted area. As they said, I had to go a half a mile away, that protesters weren't allowed to be there. We're appealing this conviction because if it stands, I'm the only person that's ever been arrested and prosecuted for this. We're concerned that the precedent will be used to legitimize what we feel is unconstitutional in the Secret Service sweeping areas of people that disagree with the president and making them go to the free speech zone. It would basically create this really expansive and undefined bubble around the president that the Secret Service can make fit whatever concerns they have and essentially legitimize these distant free speech zones for protest by making it illegal for you to be inside the bubble.
Are free speech zones a recent tactic, a recent
They certainly have been raised to a new art form under the Bush administration. I mean, I've protested presidents since, well, Richard Nixon. I was arrested protesting the Vietnam War when Richard Nixon came to town in 1969. But I've never seen anything even close to analogous to the way that they just so blatantly are telling people that they simply can't be where other parts of the public are if they're a protester. And in the instance where I was arrested, they were telling us that we had to go over a half a mile away.
Will you be speaking on your own behalf today?
No, the courts don't want to hear the criminals say anything. I have very blessed by having the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is America's premier legal agency in things of this matter, helping with the case, and an old friend of mine, Lewis Pitts, who's an attorney from South Carolina, will be arguing the case today in front of the Fourth Circuit.
What effect do you think this trial have on the future use of free speech zones?
Well, I mean, if the conviction stands, there's going to be a real clear effect in that this kind of legal gray zone, this question as to how legitimate is it for the Secret Service to act like a political advance team, pick and choose people out of a crowd to make go away. I mean, that's certainly, in my estimation, not their job, and it's unconstitutional. If this conviction stands, however, the courts will be saying that the Secret Service does have a lot of discretion in terms of where the zone is that you can't be, where the perimeters of it are, where you can't be, who can be in it. And it's that type of undefined activity on the part of the Secret Service that we're hoping the court agrees with us that it's not in keeping with the statute. The statute's very explicit, and that both in the original court conviction and my last round of appeals, both the judges mentioned in these times of terror or in this age of suicide bombers, and then the next thought that they're expressing is that, well, you know, we got to give up a little bit because it's dangerous out there. And I believe that those that one of the reasons it's dangerous out there is that we have a nation that's predicated on individual rights and liberties, and that with those rights and liberties come some threats. And Ben Franklin said, those who are willing to exchange liberty for security deserve neither. And as far as, like, surrendering our nation to forces outside that are inimical to us, I think that the surest way for us to lose what we value in this country is by giving up the type of basic freedoms and rights that we believe are part of our American heritage.
Mr. Bursey, thank you so much for coming down here and talking
Thanks
to us.
Thanks for being here. I really appreciate the work that you do with your radio station.
The court will likely take several months to deliver an opinion in the case. Richmond city government has been no stranger to conflict recently, with the city budget providing much of the controversy. This week, another financial issue took center stage as the Virginia Performing Arts Foundation appeared before the City Council to ask for an extension on its fundraising deadline for private contributions. The project, which would bring a performing arts center downtown to the Broad Street corridor on the site that once held the Tallheimer's Building, was proposed to the City Council in July 2003. The Performing Arts Center, under the initial agreement, was to be financed by a combination of public and private funds. This resulted in a meals tax, which the city imposed to create revenue for the project. The meals tax was passed with the understanding that the Performing Arts Foundation would raise a majority of the remaining funds privately, and that they would do so by June 2005. At the 2003 City Council meeting, Virginia Performing Arts Center President Brad Armstrong claimed the deadline would allow the City Council to hold the organization's, quote, feet to the fire. At the time, council members praised the deadline as a way to ensure that the city was not left holding the door. At the City Council meeting that took place this past Monday night, however, council members voted unanimously to extend the deadline. The council acted against the urging of Mayor Wilder, who has recently been critical of the project and expressed a lack of satisfaction with the foundation's plan and failure to raise the necessary funds. The mayor went so far as to request that the land be returned to the city, which is something that the mayor's press secretary, Bill Ferrer, says is still a top priority.
He definitely would like to see that happen sooner rather than later. Exactly what avenue might be pursued to make that happen is still not determined.
The council, who now hold two advisory seats on the foundation's board, has expressed their continued support of the project, with most council members indicating that they still believe the plan will make the best use of the land and the money involved in making it a reality. Some council members made clear that they would be holding the foundation accountable for their progress, which echoes the statements they made at the previous meeting 2 years ago. Reverend Dolores McQuinn, who stated that she felt the deadline was important in 2003, felt that the foundation has provided the council with enough documentation to warrant the extension.
We have requested information, and I haven't read it because I just got it this afternoon, but information so that we can assess exactly where they are, so that we will be quite informed about what they're doing, how the expenditures, you know, and the incoming dollars. So basically they have given us donors lists and what they have raised to this point, what has been promised, how much they have. And so, yeah, we intend to do all of that.
Councilwoman Ellen Robertson, who will serve as an Arts Foundation board member as part of the new proposal, sees the council's participation on the board as a way to monitor the foundation's decisions and spending. She wants the public to be able to inquire about the status of the project through town meetings.
To give them an opportunity to be in front of the public, to tell the public exactly what is going on, what they would like to see, so that those commitments that are being made throughout the city. Citizens can come to the town meetings, they can get answers to their questions, and they also can get an opportunity to really see an input into what is really going with the performance art. You know, I think that's an obligation that we have as far as a council with supporting the, you know, extending of the time for this project.
Mayor Wilder, however, feels that the time has passed to monitor the foundation from afar. On Thursday, the mayor's office confirmed that it is looking into a provision in Virginia's Freedom of Information Act that would allow the city to gain access to all aspects of the project due to the fact that it is in part funded by public money.
It's been brought to our attention that there's some interpretation of the State Freedom of Information Act that could qualify the Virginia Performing Arts Foundation as a public body susceptible to and accountable to the state's open meetings and open records requirements. We haven't come to any conclusion as to whether that is or isn't the case, but it's a suggestion that we're taking very seriously.
Mayor Wilder may be the most prominent critic of the project, but there are many Richmonders who continue to question whether the foundation, as it is currently operating, has the ability to make the Performing Arts Center a reality. The foundation's critics take issue mainly with the fact that they feel there has been little proof at this point that the current strategy and its implementation is sound, both financially and logistically. SaveRichmond.com, a website run by Andrew Bojan and Don Harrison, contains extensive documentation of the Foundation's progress in the past 2 years, as well as an archive of quotes and footage from the City Council meeting that took place in July 2003. Bojan and Harrison have long since deemed the Arts Center a poor idea, citing it as yet another example of short-sighted and unrealistic planning by a board unfamiliar or unconcerned with the needs, limitations, and expectations of the community in which it is developing. Andrew Bojan thinks there was a turning point at which the plan became ill-advised.
They didn't do a new study at that point. They decided, basically, that they were going to build a symphony hall because they figured symphony donors had a lot of money. Any studies that were done after they decided to do that, which is a completely backwards way of handling things.
Joel Katz, who resigned from the Virginia Performing Arts Foundation 2 weeks ago, has been vocal with his criticisms of the Foundation's management and planning, which he discussed on WRIR last weekend.
The current business plan for that music hall has far more non-public days of use than public days of use. And in my opinion, it was going to lose anywhere from $1 to $2 million per year. And that money would have to be raised out of the very limited cultural philanthropy pie that exists today. I didn't feel that was a good business decision to move ahead.
Katz is also concerned about where the money that has been raised over the past 2 years has gone. There's been a lack of disclosure by the foundation, who have released a number of different figures as their fundraising totals over the past few months.
It is a very private organization. Until the 990s, the IRS figures were unearthed by SaveRichmond.com. I don't think any of us had any idea how much money was being spent on what. Or how much money had been raised. And those 990 IRS documents are always a year behind. So today, I left the office 2 weeks ago and I couldn't tell you how much money's in the bank. But because the number seems to be different every time a public statement is made, I don't trust whatever number comes out of that office at this point, and I don't believe the community should either.
Katz was the executive director of the Carpenter Center for 25 years before joining the foundation's board as part of a merger when the Carpenter Center closed for renovation in December 2004. Andrew Bojan also expressed concern as to where the money has been spent and why it has been so difficult to raise the money in the first place. Bojan feels that the lack of success in fundraising may further indicate that the project is not a sound investment.
I think people look at the, you know, people with money have money for a reason. They're good at looking at business plans and good at sizing up investments. And it really doesn't take a huge amount of knowledge to see that this is a completely flawed strategy, not just for getting it built, but also for running it.
The recent actions of City Council have not left Andrew Bojan and others feeling particularly comfortable, even with the newly appointed council board members.
Certainly, Phil Panelli's speech was more cheerleading than analysis. I really can't see him being impartial about this project.
In fact, though their intentions might ultimately be good, Bojan doesn't think the council members are particularly well-informed or that they have done any real research as far as alternatives to the Performing Arts Center plan.
I think a lot of the belief is honest. I also think that a lot of the people on the board are big sources of campaign contributions, and I don't think that's the kind of thing you ignore. You know, I think also they're sincere, but they're sincerely mistaken if they think that this is the only way that we can take care of that land downtown. I don't see anything about this that couldn't be accomplished with, say, you know, a Barnes & Noble.
On Monday night, supporters of the Performing Arts Center were on hand at City Council, holding signs and wearing buttons expressing their desire to see the project come to fruition. Many of those who spoke before the council to voice their support did so in the name of arts education and the benefits that a performing arts center in the heart of Richmond would offer in that regard. Supporters also spoke from arts groups who feel that this project would help unify the Richmond arts community. Leading off the speakers who were there to support the project was Brad Armstrong, president of the Performing Arts Foundation. Armstrong has been at the center of the controversy in the past week and was unable to give an interview to WRIR before the airing of this broadcast. However, he did share his vision for the project at Monday's council meeting and illuminated his reasons for wanting to continue with the project despite fundraising woes.
This plan sprung from the arts groups. This plan has been supported by a broad, broad cross-section of people from all over the community. This is not a top-down business community plan to impose something. This whole plan came from the community, came from the people. And when I say it's a people's house, it means we're building this for the people. We're trying to understand exactly what the people want, what our programming needs to be for the people, how they will be comfortable being in here, how we can be sure that our building is appropriate for a huge, broad cross-section of folks so that everybody will feel comfortable coming into what I consider, and I hope they consider, to be their house.
Bojan feels that Armstrong should take it a step further.
You know, if he really thinks it's a people's house, he should turn the project over completely to the city of Richmond and work for a civil servant's salary. You can't have it both ways.
As Mayor Wilder has made clear, this is business that remains unfinished. The next few weeks promise to bring new developments to a story that at first seemed like a typical Richmond saga, but has turned into something that may set a critical precedent in the way the city handles some major issues.
I'm Deepa Fernandez, host of Free Speech Radio News. To get the news of the day, go to our website anytime at www.fsrn.org or listen to Free Speech Radio News weekdays on this local community radio station.
This week, WRIR News presents its first commentary from a local Richmonder.
Stop or I'll shave!
By Nate Griffith.
As I'm sure everyone is now aware, the NTSB has banned cigarette lighters on all planes. All this is done in what is purported to be the name of national security. On a recent trip to Las Vegas, I had taken measures to ensure the safety of others, and most importantly, to be in full compliance of the law by storing my lucky lighter safely away in my suitcase. Hey, it's Vegas. I need all the luck I can get, right? Now, I had first procured this lighter on a previous trip out to Sin City in one of those many grab-and-go liquor joints on the Strip. Now, I hadn't given it much thought at the time, but for whatever reason, this lighter earned its luck by making my trip, let's say, a series of modest but relatively significant monetary victories. Seeing no reason to rock the boat on a good thing, I made sure to take old Lucky up for another turn at the Vegas Burn. So we get to the hotel, we're unpacking, and I'm greeted with one of those tried and true, we've been nosing around through your things tags that these folks have fixed to questionable baggage, right? Well, after getting organized, I come to the realization that Lucky Lou himself has been unfairly usurped by those fuzzy little kittens at the NTSB. Now, seeing one of their calling cards was almost par for the course at this point, but I'd never had anything confiscated from my personal effects before. Well, let's do the math here. Had something representing a legitimate danger, and by that I mean chemicals, incendiary devices, the real dangerous stuff, you know, been found in my luggage, then kudos, key to the city, card me off, call my lawyer, evil punished. But as it stands, I had nothing in that suitcase that would pose a danger to any passenger or the public at large. The only potential danger that lighter would have posed would be to my lungs and hopefully to the casino's bottom line. So some schmoes out of one lighter, big whoop. Ironic thing, in my carry-on, within easy reach, I had my shaving kit. You know, toothbrush, assorted creams and ointments. And, of course, my razor blades. Stop, or I'll shave! Scared yet? Me either. In fact, the only folks that would have had cause for fear would have been anyone in the immediate vicinity of me having to take my shoes off at the pre-flight checkpoint. Look, this is getting way out of hand. This whole fear thing has gotten our society to a point that we can hardly tell what's a threat or even a potential threat anymore. And the more we fear, the more this kind of thing will continue to interrupt our day-to-day. Oh, well, in that case, rock on, federally mandated guardians of the public, and to the public at large. I hope that you're all sleeping well with the knowledge that a simple piece of sentimentality from an otherwise law-abiding citizen has been confiscated and destroyed. Nighty-night. Sorry, I just had to get that off my chest.
That's it for this edition of Richmond Independent Radio News. I'm Lauren Ball. I would like to thank all the volunteers who worked on this program, Matt Beckwith, Sarah Barrett, Christopher Maxwell, and Dustin Richardson. If you'd like to comment on anything you heard today, or if you would like to volunteer or submit a commentary, send an email to news@wrir.org. a great weekend.